This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Last week, Donald Trump announced a meeting with about 100 pastors in New York. Trump thought he was going to receive their endorsement even after the presidential candidate had made controversial statements about immigrants, women, and the Black Lives Matter movement. But many of the black pastors who were there say they never promised Trump an endorsement and that the meeting was an attempt to paper over Trump's rough language in reference to minorities. Trump's attempt to appeal to black voters is one of the topics we'll talk about today on Culture 360. Joining me in the studio, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker and also a professor of film and media studies at St. Augustine's University. Natalie, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
And Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke, the author of the book New Black Man and host of the weekly webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
Let's talk about this, Mark. What do you think about this meeting between Donald Trump and black pastors?
The first thing I thought, it was like straight out of the Rudolph Giuliani playbook. I remember when Giuliani was mayor in New York City, you know, he would very often do an end around the traditional leadership within the black community and often would cut deals with black leadership in Brooklyn as opposed to the Harlem base where you had folks like Charlie Rango and Al Sharpton and those folks. So his attempts to do that didn't surprise me. And of course, there is this perception that the black church, black clergy still hold a kind of moral sway, you know, that translate into some sort of political influence within the black community. So in some ways, it's you know, politics 101, right? If you want to reach the black community, you do that by reaching out to black ministers.
Natalie, what do you think?
I agree. I mean, I didn't think about Rudolph Giuliani, but I... Well, I have to say that I was pretty outraged when I found out that these pastors were meeting with Trump. And I think that has to do with my background. I was raised in the Christian church. And so I guess I've come to expect a certain amount of integrity, although I know that, you know, we're all human, number one, but also that not all pastors walk the walk and talk the talk.
Well, I was going to, Mark, let me ask you, because you said something about traditional black leadership and you're talking about not all black pastors walk the walk. I mean, so who gets to speak? I mean, this does point to that question.
No, that really is, you know, part of what's going on here. I mean, there's assumption that when we think about black clergy, right, particularly black clergy who ascend to some sort of notion of leadership. Again, when we talk about Martin Luther King, we talk about Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson. These are all folks who came out of the tradition of black clergy. So there's an assumption, first of all, that those voices are always on the liberal left. And that in some cases they're progressive. But, you know, if we take as an example just the gender politics, you know, and the sexual politics within some black churches, which are incredibly conservative, there's no reason to think that their politics might not also be conservative within that context. So I'm sure there's a few amount of those ministers that actually are folks who are following Donald Trump or Republicans in that kind of way. And so we always have to be conscious that, you know, the black community isn't a monolith.
That's right.
And the black church isn't a monolith. Right. I think the really radical thing for Trump would have been to sit down with some black imams. Right. You know, because they're also part of this structure of leadership within the black community.
And I think it also, you know, I think it's very telling of just what we've seen with Trump in terms of him talking loud and saying a lot of nothing. And I think that he, you know, it would have been appropriate and I think very timely if he had actually sat down with members of the Black Lives Matter movement. Like that would have been a meeting that I think would have yielded him perhaps more of what he's looking for. Possibly, if they were even willing to meet with him, you know.
And if that's what he's looking for.
And if that's right, what he's right, looking right, for, right. That's true. But I just think that, you know, the fact that he went this, you know, it's almost stereotypical to go the route of the black church, you know, and to try and win over black people. Because as Mark said, we aren't a monolith. Yeah. There are a lot of folk who don't even go to church, who don't believe in Christianity.
Well, you wonder if a more progressive leaning or someone whose rhetoric has been more progressive and who had more liberal ideas would even have thought to do that, because there's something faintly perhaps racist about just gathering a group of people behind you and saying, see, they're all behind me.
Right. I mean, I think that occurs on the left also. I mean, Michael Dyson's piece in The New Republic, you know, talks about Hillary Clinton going to meet with black liberal left clergy in Atlanta, you know, so that they could put their hands on her. Right. So, you know, both sides of the political spectrum do the same thing. But of course, because we expect that black ministry and the black clergy is always left liberal, we find the Donald Trump meeting surprising.
Well, for Donald Trump, it was a great meeting. Let's listen.
I don't think we had backlash. I mean, I saw love in that room. I see love everywhere I go. I see tremendous amounts. Like right now, I'm getting on a plane. I'm going to Georgia. We're going to have a tremendous crowd in Georgia, just like we did in Sarasota. We had 12,000 people, an all-time record by double. And we're going to have a tremendous crowd. I'm literally leaving right now. In fact, because the meeting went so much longer, and it went longer only because of the love. It didn't go longer for other reasons. There were unbelievable solutions, I think, to problems that we will solve that other people won't be able to solve.
Mr. Trump, what were the
criteria? Feeling the love. Although I think when Donald Trump walks into the room, he's always feeling love. I'm guessing a lot of it does come from himself. Just a possibility that when he, but that, who knows? Anyway, he felt the love. I will say that when Bishop Paul Morton appeared on CNN, Bishop Paul Morton declined the invitation. He wasn't feeling the love at all.
What Donald Trump is representing right now, the insults, the degrading, is not what we're all about. So for me to endorse somebody like that, where you have no respect for people, I mean, with the women, I think that was a disgrace. And just the disabled reporter, that is unbelievable. Even the way they pulled the man out, Black Lives Matter, it's like a bully in the 21st century.
Well, that's a clip of Bishop Paul Morton on CNN this week talking about why he declined the invitation of Donald Trump to meet with black leaders in New York. Natalie, Trump repeatedly called out the Black Lives Matter movement. He still claims he's going to win over black voters. You said it might be wise for him to talk with the leadership of that movement. What impact do you think that's having on this race in general, both Republicans and Democrats, Black Lives Matter?
Well, I definitely think that Black Lives Matter and the way that they have disrupted, you know, business as usual has changed the whole way that politics are going to have to be thought about and performed. Because I don't think that a lot of the issues that matter to black people would even be approached by really any of the candidates in the ways that they have been forced to address them because they have been called on the carpet by Black Lives Matter activists, or they've, you know, the activists have gotten on stage and forced them to talk about the issues. So I think they've made a huge difference in this presidential election.
Can either party, Mark, afford to ignore the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think the Republicans can. Yeah. I think the Republicans have ignored young black people, at least, you know, for some time now. I think it's a dicier question for Democrats and only about in terms of turnout. You know, the reality of what Hillary Clinton has to deal with in a year ago is that is there going to be an excitement amongst the black electorate, particularly the young black electorate that was, you know, electrified with Obama in 2008, less so in 2012. How does Hillary Clinton tap into that, you know, that kind of energy? And I think that's something that's still up in the air. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure at this moment that Black Lives Matter even is something that can deliver that, right? Mm-hmm. Because Black Lives Matter is not about, right, you know, these kind of traditional forms of electoral policy, politics, though they are clearly trying to impact upon policy.
That's right.
What about, let's talk, we haven't talked about Ben Carson yet and his fall in the polls. Is there any comparison to be made? There certainly was when they were neck and neck.
Between Carson and Trump?
Ben Carson and Donald Trump, yeah.
I think the thing that I'm noticing about Carson is that his rhetoric is similar, not as bombastic as Trump's, but Carson seems to be willing to at least admit when he has said something really crazy and dial it back. Trump is, you know, you call him out on something that he says and he just double downs on it. So I think that's a good thing. It may actually be a liability for Carson. Yeah, it's helped him. But I don't know that it, you know, I don't think it was helping Carson. I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, it just seems that Carson, he doesn't come across in the same like aggressive, hyper-masculine way that Trump does. And I think that there is a real desire. That hyper-masculinity that Trump is always exerting is very appealing to a group of the population, a part of the population.
quite honestly, I don't have the amount of wisdom to explain why Donald Trump, Ben Carson, or Ted Cruz are at the top of anybody's list. Mm-hmm. That said, Ben Carson is, you know, as folks are being vetted more seriously, Ben Carson is increasingly looking like a sketchy black man. And I think that's something that's also contributing to his downward spiral, you know, in the polls.
I wonder if I just read recently where somebody wrote that Donald Trump is a CAT scan on the central nervous system of the Republican Party, revealing fissures and growths that have been going on for quite some time. And he's still on top of the polls. I mean, what does it say about this election in terms of the kinds of rhetoric we're going to hear and the issues that are going to decide this race?
I think you're talking about folks who clearly want something at this moment. And they don't know what it is yet, right? And so it just becomes the rhetoric of change, the rhetoric of difference. There's no question that Trump represents something that's new and different, you know, in terms of electoral politics, in terms of what he represents, where he comes from, what his experience is. But in terms of some of the ideas, I mean, you know, and the fact find, you know, the fact that folks are doing fact finding now, like his comments about the celebrations in New Jersey after 9/11, and they're being debunked on all sides. And as Natalie says, he continues to double down. And I think there's an electorate that finds that very appealing.
And right? It doesn't
Especially
hurt.
When we talk about white male working class men who feel disaffected. Suddenly Donald Trump, who didn't speak to them at all 20 years ago, right, are speaking to him now because of that style of rhetoric.
I want to continue our conversation on Culture 360 with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But first, we'll take this break. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, continuing our regular radio series, Culture 360, examining black identity, culture, politics, and media. My guest, Natalie Bullock Brown from St. Augustine's University and Mark Anthony Neal from Duke. Natalie, we were talking about the Black Lives Matter movement earlier, and we're seeing another type of protest happening on college campuses across the country. Talk more about those protests and whether or not the to what extent Black Lives Matter is a part of that, engendered that, propels it, and to what extent it's something else all by itself.
Oh well, I think there are two things. I think that students are forever have been dealing with inequities on campus, African-American students in particular. When I was in college, way back when, we had similar issues and we did kind of similar things, but not in the same way that we've been seeing students really come out and protest. And you know, in the case of Mizzou and Jonathan Butler, put their life on the line until something changes. I think that the extent to which students have been emboldened and empowered to protest in the ways that they have is absolutely a direct result of Black Lives Matter. I think you can't even begin to talk about these recent campus protests without pointing back to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think that because Black Lives Matter is very much young youth oriented or youth propelled, that the student protests are also feeding and helping to propel forward the Black Lives Matter movement. So they work hand in hand, but and certainly the issues are the same. You know, it's they're the same, but they are certainly in different spheres of concern, and the students they are. What am I trying to say? I feel like they have, because of the nature of campus life and the fact that, in many ways you are in a you're in a microcosm of the larger world. I think that the fact that they can't go anywhere, you know.
Well, it's so a more intimate environment. Certainly.
Absolutely. And so when you have the sort of threats that certainly the students at Mizzou and some other campuses were experiencing, like, what do you do? You know, do you abort your education because of these threats? And I think that is something that's, definitely sort of a standout characteristic of what the students have to deal with that is a little different from what Black Lives Matter activists have to deal with on a regular basis.
Yeah, Mark?
There's no question. I think they've seen the possibilities of what they can do. But I think by that same token, they have to navigate the fact that what Black Lives Matter does in terms of disrupting everyday life, in terms of disrupting media perceptions of what's happening on the ground, is very different than the kind of disruption that they have to do on college campuses. And there is a tradition of protests on Black college campuses that I don't think they've been as so open to draw to. I mean, because this is part of it, right? We've seen, you could hear young folks saying, we've seen all these protests, we've seen all the video footage, et cetera. We haven't seen this in our real life. So the real life example is Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, universities are set up to be able to manage these kinds of protests, right? What a university leadership always knows is that at the longest, in 4 years, this student will be gone,
right?
And so, you know, we appeased them for a couple of years to move the problem out, and there's no institutional memory around protest traditions.
Right.
And all of that gets lost, and some student comes in or a group of students comes in and it has to be rebuilt over again.
That's true.
Is this tethered, do you think? Is this part of a lineage? Is there a genealogy of campus protest, or is this out of whole cloth? Is this sort of the millennial digital age version of college campus protest?
No, this is definitely a continuum. And I think it's exactly, you know, because of what Mark just said, that there's no sustained effort from graduating class to graduating class, because you are only on campus for so long. I went to Northwestern University, and in 1968, I think it was, there was a huge student movement, Black student movement, and a sit-in at the bursar's office and all kinds of activity around the ways that Black students were being treated, not being provided for, resources were not in place. There was no Department of or Office of African American Student Affairs. All these things came out of those protests. And so I got to benefit from those things. But there were still issues.
Right.
It was still not perfect when I got there, and I got there almost 20 years later. So, it's absolutely a continuum. And I think what Mark brought up is really interesting, because how do students, Black students, sustain that effort? What can be done to keep that going, even though, you know, I'm about to graduate as a senior or whatever the case may be?
I think there are a couple of things that are important to remember. And, you know, Frank probably remembers this more than the two of us, Natalie.
What are you saying?
but you know, the campus protests that we see in the late 1960s, whether it's about Vietnam or just, you know, things like curfews, I mean, those protests rock institutions across this country. And those institutions adapted and fundamentally sustainable ways.
Right.
You know, it got to the point that you're seeing shootings of Black students at Jackson State. You're seeing shootings of Black students down at Orangeburg. You're seeing shootings of white students at Kent State.
Right.
You know, and most of the students who are protesting don't have no knowledge of that kind of history. So institutions adapt, right? President's offices get moved to different places on campus so they can't be taken over by students. There's a whole architecture in the State University of New York of universities that were built during the Rockefeller era that were set up to be protest-proof.
University of Buffalo took them out to the suburbs. There is no center. It is a golf course with buildings.
But the sustainability piece is important, because, and this is where it's different between the protests we see at Missouri and, say, the protests we see at Yale or at Duke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we see amongst these upper elite schools is that typically they will recruit kids from the best prep schools in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So even if it's a kid coming from South Central, it's a kid that's now spending 4 years at Exeter, right, and then going on to Duke or Yale or someplace else, which is very different than bringing in the brightest kid from South Central who's going to a public school.
That's right.
And that movement becomes sustainable for him because he's bringing home with him.
That's right.
Right. He's not leaving the hood with him when he comes to a Duke or a Princeton or someplace like that.
That's right.
So he comes in already trying to think about, how do I build something that's sustainable, and looks to mentor other folks she looks to mentor other folks to do that same kind of work.
That's right. Yeah, I agree. And I think that there, Mark said something that
he does that all the time.
He does. He said something that set off bells in my head. And I think I think that there is that the point he's making is really good, because I think that there is an urgency that comes to campus with students who are coming from maybe some conditions that then are repeated on their campus.
Right.
There is more of a perhaps a need and an investment in making sure that those things change. And I think that, you know, maybe I don't know the background. Actually, yes, I do. I know the background of Jonathan mm-hmm. Butler at Missouri. Apparently, he comes from a upper middle class family, but he was done. I mean, he was through with what was going on that campus. And was he is he a football player?
No, he's a grad student.
He's a grad student. Yeah. And so, you know, maybe I think there's something to be said about an older student being willing to make that type of commitment to, you know, I'm not going to eat until this president is gone. But certainly I think the football players at Mizzou, and I'm making some assumptions, mm-hmm. and I realize that, so I'm going to acknowledge that. But I think that generally the athletes, the student athletes, the black student athletes that come to college campuses are, in many ways, they're the ones who are primed to do this type of...
Particularly from football teams.
Absolutely.
Because right? football teams are so large. It's different than basketball because you talk about a smaller amount of players, but in terms of football teams, yeah.
Primed to do why?
Well, because I think that the backgrounds, I mean, a lot of times the students, the football players are coming, the only way that they can go to college, and sometimes the only way that they can go to, you know, a Big Ten college or an elite college is because they get a sports scholarship. But they are, in some ways, they are like the slaves of campus.
The most vulnerable.
Absolutely.
At least like they protest, right?
And, you know, Natalie, what you see is that also it plays out in the National Football League, where National Football League players tend to be more politically sophisticated than black players than you see in basketball and black players that you see, you know, in say, other sports like baseball, because they are coming from a kind of rank-and-file experience, you know, that were given opportunity, but they never forget those experiences, right? But it also means their experiences are very often fraught, right? Because they are still so close to the hood, if you will, in some of these cases, right? And they're also trying to navigate that stuff also.
Yes.
Right. And it's a double-edged sword, too, it seems to me, because one of the other sort of failings of that protest movement of the 60s, in quotes, was the fact that it was a sort of an elite educated, right? And so this is a very small percentage of the population that is noticing the amount of violence and racism that's corrupting a whole nation. Yeah. It wasn't a grassroots movement, and in that sense, it has to do less with the 4-year, you know, the transience of the population than the elite kind of quality of the protesters. We saw that in liberation movements in the post-war era. They were led by elites and ultimately unsustainable, and there were some grassroots cultural issues that sort of went unaddressed in that, and they were not sustainable. I mean, are we facing the same thing, that this is a lot of noise? Maybe we'll see some change on some college campuses, but the sustainability has less to do with transience than it does with who's involved in the movement.
Yeah, I think what's been important about this moment, you know, these institutions, these students get to share information in ways that they could not have before because of social media. Mm-hmm. But again, when we see what was happening at Wits University in South Africa, where students are protesting about student fees, you know, very basic things, right? We need to be able to afford to go to school, and we're going to protest about that. And they're drawing from the influence of Black Lives Matter, you know, at least in terms of strategy and some of the rhetoric. So I think it's a different kind of moment. I think there's a chance for some very real possibility if the students are very thoughtful about what are the kinds of things that they actually demand, right? And like, I think most students don't understand that if you want to change a college campus, you know, the president is a figurehead, but the president takes his directions from the board of trustees. Mm-hmm. And if you're not talking to the board of trustees, right, you're not really going to move the needle in any significant way.
And go ahead, Natalie.
No, I just wanted to say about Mizzou and you know, what I thought was a game changer, and it certainly seemed to be the game changer, and that was the when the 30 black football players basically said, we're not going to play, you know, unless some things change, unless the president resigns. I feel like that doesn't happen enough. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen enough on our campuses, whether they are historically black colleges and universities or predominantly white institutions, where the athletes are able to sort of rise up and realize, you know what even though I have a scholarship, I've got all these things that are going for me and that are being provided for me because of the sport that I play, you know, these are the people that are protesting, that I'm watching protest, they're protesting for me, you know, the issues that they are protesting and advocating for, they affect me as well. And I guess I'm thinking about my own college experience where the football players were so sequestered from the rest of us that it almost felt like, you know, they didn't even belong to us.
Well, they had a lot to lose. I mean, that's the point. There is a privilege that you get, even if you're having to endure something else. There is this privilege of a free education and the
access
chance
to
of
tutoring.
Playing,
yeah.
tutoring. Maybe I'll get to the NFL. So actually, there's a lot at stake if you choose to go on strike.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. There is a big risk. But that does seem to be, you know, at least in Missouri, that was the thing that got, you know, people's attention.
Well, it's non-participation, right? That's the centerpiece of nonviolent activism, which is non-participation with the thing you consider evil. So strike is one, boycott is the other, which brings us to Blackout Black Friday movement in its second year. How did that go? And is that a movement now? Because that's the continuum. Once you leave college, you will always be a consumer, and there's your chance.
That's true. I don't know. I don't know if I would say that the Blackout Black Friday, if that's a movement. I don't know if it rose to that. If it's risen to that yet. I saw a lot of activity on Facebook around that. I think there was a lot going on Twitter as well. I certainly participated. I know people who participated. I've heard from news reports that Black Friday, which I hate that term, but that Black Friday was, in terms of sales, it was one of the lowest years.
Down 10% second time in the year.
Yeah. And so maybe that's as a result of Blackout Black Friday. I'm not sure. But
and what is it? Blackout Black Friday. Describe it for us.
Well, it's basically, at least from a black perspective, it's about not buying into the idea of giving all your money to Walmart and Target and department stores and Best Buy and whatever the day after Thanksgiving and realizing that, you know what, maybe my dollars would be better spent if I reinvest in my community. Mm-hmm. So there were, in Durham, there was something called the Black Market, where black artisans and business owners were, I think, at the Durham Arts Council, and they sold their wares, you know, all day long. And so that was an alternative to Black Friday.
Sure.
And I think that a lot of people took advantage of that.
I think it's part of a continuum. I mean, when you think about, you know, Harlem Buy Black campaigns in Harlem in the 1930s to be able to get white-owned businesses to hire black folks and saying, you know, we're not going to buy in your store. So there have always been these efforts to manage and exploit black economic power, you know, by choosing to boycott in very strategic kinds of ways. So I think Blackout Black Friday is another example of that, right? It also reminds me of Douglas Turner Ward's play from the late 1960s, you know, A Day of Absence, right? What does it mean for black folks to choose strategically different days of the year to disappear from the marketplace, right? What kind of ripple effect does that have, right, on the economy when black folks who are seen as certain kinds of consumers, right? And we know that we're targeted because we see the commercials when we're watching Scandal and when we're watching, you know, Being Mary Jane. What happens if we choose to retreat from that for a little while to be able to show what our economic power actually represents?
Well, that would be. I mean, if you think about it, and we know that in terms of Black Friday, African-American and Latino participation is disproportionately high in that whatever sales they reap. So is that non-participation? Is that kind of the next stage of this protest? Getting back to your board of trustees, there's a figurehead and then there's where the money is, right?
I think it has to be multifaceted. I mean, I think, you know, social media allows for us to think in that very kind of complex way about different places, you know, different sites of protest, you know, whether it's the marketplace, college campuses, whether or not it's mainstream media, you know, which, you know, folks do very effectively doing social media, whether or not it's challenging law enforcement, right? We're dealing with a conflation of an incredible tensions and issues and challenges. And so the responses have to be multifaceted in that way also.
Yeah.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about all things Culture 360 today. Natalie Bullock-Brown, Mark Anthony Neal are my guest. We'll talk more about the Rush card coming up, the debit card, again, a kind of a consumer model, and how that plays into all of these questions today on The State of Things. My guest, professors of pop culture and experts, Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. Culture 360 takes a look at black filmmakers in Hollywood and the policing of end zone celebrations in the NFL. All of that coming up on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we continue our series Culture 360, examining black identity, culture, politics, and media with my guests, regular contributors Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, we got an email from someone who heard you say a few minutes ago, we were talking about college football, and you called them slaves of the campus. What did you mean?
I basically meant that because football players work for free, and on the strength of their labor, the campuses, the colleges and universities that they play for make millions of dollars, and none of that is seen by the players. That's essentially slavery.
I mean, they get a college education, right?
They do get a college education, if I remember anything about my own college experience, and I teach now, and I have football players who are my students, and what I see is that there's so much emphasis placed on playing football that the education part becomes a second priority. And so, I mean, I think it's fair to question, and I think people have asked the question, are football players really graduating from college with the type of education that's going to sustain them in their lives?
And I always want to push back when folks say, well, they're getting a free college education. You know, athletes are not the only college students who are getting scholarships to go to college. You know, they have a particular gift that translates into a scholarship, as does the engineering student or as does the chemistry student. But no one holds them to the same kinds of standards. Right. And no one says that a chemistry student should be happy because they're getting a free education, but they're willing to say that to the black football player who might have come from the hood, right?
That's right.
Who is getting this opportunity because he does, in fact, have a skill and a talent that is usable, right? Even more so than the chemistry student with the high GPA, much more usable and valuable to the institution's bottom line. Right. Then the other student that might have a particular
That's
skill.
Right.
Well, and I've heard the term used about athletes, both black and white. And again, because of that and also because of the amount of revenue they generate, that the sports generate revenues in the way other scholarship students don't.
Right.
But in any event, there is at least some kind of material.
And other scholarship
exchange.
Sports don't. Right. You know,
right.
So football is unique because basketball doesn't generate that kind of income either.
That's right.
Right. So but football is a whole different terrain, which is why even the University of Missouri, which doesn't have a great football team, but the amount of money they generate is important to that university because it is, in fact, a football program that generates a lot of income.
Right. Well, speaking of football, let's talk about the Carolina Panthers, 11-0, number one. And two, their quarterback, Cam Newton, has been doing great this year, had an amazing year. It recently came under fire for his touchdown celebrations. They're elaborate and gleeful. And he's taking a lot of heat for those, Mark. What's going on?
So there's a couple of things, right? I want to reach out, first of all, to some of my dance historian colleagues. It's like, you know, can you give us like a little thing on what the dap is, right? Because that's the thing, right? We're talking about a football player who's from the South, right, who's drawing on a regional style of dance, right, vernacular dance, that very few people outside of that vernacular space know, right? So that's a first distance between what he's doing and what the audience sees. But, you know, there's always been these, you know, it's these end zone celebrations, right? I grew up watching Billy White Choose Johnson for the Houston Oilers, right? And everybody loved that, right? I remember the Icky Woods dance, right? And Iggy's still dancing in commercials now, right, in 2015. Yeah. I also remember Mark Gastineau, right, sacking quarterbacks as part of the sack exchange. I was a Jet fan, right, and him doing his little dance, right? And the NFL policed that, right? That's the reason why we don't see those kind of celebrations in the field of playing anymore, but we do see them in the end zone. But I think there's actually something else at play with Cam Newton, right? Because there's lots of athletes that do some sort of celebration. But, you know, Cam has been that kind of athlete, and we often see that black athletes, who seem too arrogant, who seem too self-assured, draw a certain kind of ire, right? We saw that in baseball with Barry Bonds, right? We see that to some extent with folks like someone like Cam Newton. And, you know, I tell folks all the time, I wasn't necessarily a big Carolina Panther fan, but when Carolina drafted Cam, right, given all his skill set, and I'm listening to local sports radio, and the way they would talk about him without saying that the problem was that he was black, actually became a Panther fan that rooted for Cam Newton just because of the vitriol that was directed at Cam Newton, who at this time is 21 years old, you know, has not been arrested, you know, doing domestic abuse or raping anybody. For all things we know, is a good kid, right, and a good citizen. It's like, okay, what's this about? And again, it's about these certain kind of perceptions of what black masculinity looks like on the field, particularly when it's self-assured, right? So we're here references to black athletes who don't carry themselves that way as being the model example, right, of how an athlete should be, right? So even when you think about the NBA a decade ago, you know, folks might have been critical of like a Latrell Sprewell, but then they would hold up someone like David Robinson as this is the right way to act, right? Carmelo Anthony or Kobe, you know, that's not the right way to act. Tim Duncan, that's the right way to carry yourself, right? And so I think Cam Newton is another example of those kinds of tensions.
Is there an argument to be made, though, that just getting it back to the game, that there's got to be some policing, some limit? Otherwise, there'd be this arms race and the amount of dancing you would do in the game. We'd never get on with the game because they have some material value for this athlete going on. You've got discount double check and the icky shuffle and all those things become commodifiable.
Right.
You can imagine this thing going on for hours.
And of course, no one's talking about Aaron Rodgers in that context.
And the discount
double check. He's actually drawing a whole nother, paycheck from this that Cam Newton will never have the opportunity to, right? You know, Cam Newton's not going to be dabbing for Geico, anytime in the future. I mean, that's just the reality of it, right? And I can appreciate, you know, because I'm sort of old school with this, right? And can I appreciate with this idea that if you're in the zone, end zone, act like you've actually been there before. I get that. But also when you're a quarterback, And you know, you're going up against all these 365-pound players, and you're able to do what Cam Newton does just simply on his skill set and his talent. I'm like, whatever, bro. You have your dance, right? And it even works more for me because you're my team. So,
yep. There is the Lambeau leap, by the way, which is not considered an excessive celebration.
Prohibition, right.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, it's all of that. I don't know if you want to weigh in on this. I don't want to, you know, make this a kind of a gendered assumption on my part, Natalie. But football might not be your thing.
Football is something that I have struggled for years to understand. I'm just going to say that. And the only reason why I have, I guess, like some sort of interest in it is because my son plays. But that said, I mean, I have watched. I used to love to watch college basketball and professional basketball, and I think that there definitely is a difference between the ways that black athletes are regarded and policed. You know, that white athletes don't have to worry about. And actually, when we, you know, when I found out we were going to be talking about Cam Newton and this policing of his end zone dancing, it sort of made me think about Serena Williams and the ways in which people, you know, just had so much issue with how she would celebrate her, you know, grand slams or her wins or a point. I think it has everything to do with the fact that these are black athletes who are confident. They're non-apologetic. They don't really care what people think about them, and they are good at what they do. They are elite. I mean, you know, in their sports, and so they have every right to celebrate and to celebrate in whatever way that they want, within the rules.
Frank used a great word, right? He talks about, you know, how the NFL talks about excessive celebration. But, you know, but this is a reality, and Serena is a great example of this also. There, in many ways, the black body is excessive, right, to the white gaze,
right?
Just being there. So when, you know, the black body is doing something extra context, it becomes even much more of a problem very often for the white gaze.
Yes. And can I just add, I also think, you know, Mark mentioned that he was making the comparison between what Cam does and
Aaron Rodgers
and I'm not familiar with Aaron Rodgers, but okay. So I would imagine that,
and you probably know him only because of the commercials.
Yes. Oh, that's right. Exactly. But I think that, you know, it's a matter of who is considered respectable and appropriately thankful for where they, you know, the position that they have achieved. And so if an athlete, you know, points up and at God to say thank you, or, you know, as a form of celebration, as opposed to a dance or any sort of activity that seems too boisterous, then, you know, there's a problem. And I think, you know, that's a problem because we're being pigeonholed. Black people in general are pigeonholed into the space where we cannot express our joy, our glee even, over achievement and over being in a space where we know we belong because we've worked hard to get there.
It's the way that Russell Wilson gets treated differently than Marshawn Lynch.
How so? What do you mean?
In the sense that he gets a pass just to be okay, right? Where when you talk about Richard Sherman or Marshawn Lynch, Richard Sherman, who's very outspoken about racial issues, and Marshawn Lynch, who just refuses to play the game at all, so doesn't speak at all, right? And so they get critiqued in a certain kinds of ways that Russell Wilson doesn't, because Russell Williams is always pointing to the sky and being thankful for his gifts and those kinds of things, right? So he's palatable to the white gaze, at least on the sports field, in ways that, say, a Richard Sherman and a Marshawn Lynch aren't. And that's on the same team, right?
Yeah. You know, sort of on another subject, the pointing to the sky, I think when I see opposing players, like players on opposing team, and they each point to the sky, and then, like, say, the Jets lose, I think, well, God hates the Jets. What does that mean? What does that mean anyway? Hey, let's get back to consumer politics, putting your money where your mouth is. The Rush debit card, backlash from the glitches, technical glitches. But there's been a long history of, we're talking about Russell Simmons, hip-hop impresario. He's got his own debit card, and he's been doing it since 2003. And he says, look, this is a way to bring money to unbanked poor people. I'm providing a service for them. There's the technical glitch, which left people without money for, you know, weeks. That's one problem. But the other question is the fees and whether or not he's simply capitalizing on their poverty. What do you make of all this, Mark?
Can you say payday loans?
Yeah.
Payday loans and blackface, for lack of a better way to describe it.
Yeah, basically. I think that I guess the intention is good. To try and provide a way for an underserved Black people to have a banking experience, if you will. But at the same time, the Rush card, in just the concept of it, is something that is it's kind of rampant in the Black community, in poor Black communities, where, you know, instead of having a check card or a debit card, you do get this prepaid card. But yes, it's almost highway robbery in terms of the amount of fees that you're paying. And it is very similar to payday loans where, you get this amount of money against the check that you are expecting. But, I mean, by the time you pay all the fees, you're not getting your whole check. You're getting a portion of it. So is it really doing a service? I hesitate to judge Russell Simmons because I don't know enough about what his motivation really is for providing this service and how much he's benefiting from doing this. But on the face of it, it doesn't really look like it's helping Black people in the ways that maybe he intended.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of issues at stake here. One is the fact that it costs you a lot of money to be poor in America, right? It's expensive. Right. Because if I've got enough money in the bank, they don't charge me a thing.
Right.
So I've got free checking and free savings, and they don't charge me for every transaction, but I have to have money to do that. If I don't, I'm either not in the bank.
You don't have to finance purchases and then take on finance fees. I mean, all those things, right?
So it costs a lot of money. But then the question is, are we holding, you know, Russell Simmons to a different standard? Are we saying, you know, is this something he's doing to his own people? And is that a fair critique? Because he's not the only one out there with these cards. And payday loans are a big business still, even post-2008.
Right.
They're still a big business. And there's all kinds of people benefiting. And I wonder about the assumption that he shouldn't be doing this to Black people.
You know, there's a way in which you have to be very real about thinking about folks who are involved in high finance. When all is said and done, some of them are more green than anything.
That's right.
You know, there are white folks who are more green than white. You know, so we shouldn't be surprised that, you know, Black folks like a Russell Simmons who might be more green than Black. But, you know, part of the issue is that when you hear other kinds of rhetoric from someone like Russell Simmons, about being concerned. It's like, it's one thing if you're not hearing rhetoric that attempts to, at some level, to be progressive and left liberal right. about concerns of the black community. If you're that person, then it's like you are who you are. But when you're also getting this kind of exploitive behavior attached to rhetoric to suggest that you actually care about communities, that's when it becomes problematic. Like, you can't be Bob Johnson running BET and talk about your concern about the images of black folks and then produce what you produce to be consumed by the public, right? Folks are going to call you out for that kind of behavior.
Exactly.
I want to get move on to Spike Lee because we're running short of time. Got an honorary Oscar at the 2015 Governor's Awards and a video posted by the awards. He gave a talk, but talk about that honorary award. Mark, start with you.
It's way too late. You know, there's a way in which it's too late for him. You know, he should have gotten an Oscar already, but he's also too young to be getting an honorary Oscar. You know, it's a weird dynamic. You know, I think it's the Academy on one level being embarrassed by Oscars so white a year ago, right? And so they're trying to look at some sort of way to deal with equity. There's no question that Spike Lee has been one of the most important directors, if not problematic and controversial, all those kinds of things, you know, as much as Woody Allen has been, you know, and for different reasons. So I think it's a chance to redress some of the equity or lack of equity in that regard. And of course, you know, it's perfect for Spike because he's dropping a new film and he gets to use that as a springboard, you know, to promote his own film, right, in ways that we actually haven't seen Spike Lee promote a film since the very early days, right, when it was all about him doing the hustle and the promotion of it.
Nelly?
Right. I agree with Mark. I mean, I think it's too little. Well, it is too little too late, because there's certainly Spike has certainly produced and directed films that were absolutely worthy of an Oscar, either for him as a director or Best Picture. I mean, his biopic on Malcolm X that Denzel Washington starred in, I think that should have gotten Best Picture. It may have been up for Best Picture, but Spike should have gotten at least a nod as a director. I'm a little put out with Spike right now, so I'm not his biggest fan. But, you know, at the same time, he's the reason why I went to film school. He is the reason why I even dared to believe that I could be a filmmaker. So I love the brother for that. But I think that he has, there's no but. I think that he should have gotten this type of recognition long ago.
All right, we'll talk about your falling out the next time we get together on Culture 360. Natalie Bullock-Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker, teaches at St. Augs. Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke. More information about them at our website. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.